the fact that in the first 10 years of pursuing to get those files, I have letters that come from both the CIA and the FBI assuring me with all honesty and without having done all due diligence and deep research, such documents don't exist. There are none. And eventually we had other sources that came through other ways in which they began to look through files and saw my name and situations.
Like Taylor Branch, the historian.
Taylor Branch, the historian. He was most revealing in what he had done with the research. But also journalists and other people who were digging to get stories on other subjects came across those files and informed us. And then finally, the FBI capitulated. And the first documents they sent, about hundreds of pages, 99% of those pages were just one big black stroke. So the insult against intelligence to send those kinds of files to a citizen whose rights were being violated was an insult to not only intelligence, but a crushing of the rights to information and to living in a society that is more open and transparent.
Talk about the march from Selma to Montgomery and who you brought down and the fear at that time and how these artists were also a kind of protection, the front lines, if you will, to protect the people who are at great risk, whose names were not famous.
I think all the artists who did this understood that there was the threat to life, and that some irrational person somewhere or some irrational group somewhere would find it very adventurous to mark them as one of the targets. There'd be a lot of heroism coming from the clan of these retarded people, emotionally and socially, to say they killed a celebrity, which in fact became in vogue not too shortly after this period. Look what they did to John Kennedy and to so many others, Dr. King and etc. But these artists understood that. It wasn't, they were not blinded by it. They weren't blind to it, I should say. And by putting themselves on the line, it heightened public curiosity. And in heightening public curiosity, it meant that things were forced to be more transparent. And they weren't quite ready to reveal themselves that way. I'm talking about the opposition. Except it's important to note that at the very night of our concert and the night thereafter was when Mrs. Liuzzo was murdered. And as a matter of fact, in the car in which she had taken one of the members of our group to the airport, she was on her way back. Tony Bennett gave up his seat in that ride.
Tony Bennett was there.
He was there. And we gave up his seat to someone else, to Mrs. Liuzzo and the young man that was with her.
And she was a white woman who wanted to support the struggle, the civil rights struggle, by driving people.
Yes. She was a member of the Automobile Workers Union. And she volunteered to come down and was one of the organizers. And she drove cars to give people facility back and forth to the different places in which artists had to reside. And in doing that service, on her way back from the airport, she fell a target to murderers who killed her. That was to have been Tony Bennett's car. It was also important, I think, because the kind of artists that came down didn't have a platform in which they were going to be very visible. Singers could always be heard. But Leonard Bernstein came down. And when he and I spoke, Leonard said, "I don't sing. There'll be no orchestra to conduct. But morally, I feel an obligation to let my presence be seen and to let people draw whatever strength from that they might be able to garnish to know that their struggle has touched all of us." So there are many who people don't even know about.
You also helped fund Freedom Summer.
Yes.
Talk about that, putting your finances behind the struggle. I mean, you now, what, in 55 or before, had the first gold record, Calypso, gold million-selling record. First one in this country. Some had singles, but you had the record.
Yeah, it was the first album to achieve the sales of a million. And beyond all of the hoopla that came with that fact from the commercial end, the studio and the record company, what was very prophetic about that moment for me was that it became symbolic of an instruction that Paul Robeson had given me. And he said, get them to sing your song, and they'll want to know who you are. And in that little exchange down in the dressing room at the Village Vanguard, I woke up not too long after that wonderful piece of counsel to understand what he meant, because that song, that album housed the song Banana Boat Day-o, and the whole world was singing the song in the literal sense. But also, when I looked at the thousands of people that came to the stadiums to hear that song and others, I realized that the world was singing my song. And in Robeson's counsel, this was the opportunity to begin to spread truth and to open up opportunities for information to flow. It was the opportunity to reach out to other artists who may not have been heard otherwise or needed to be heard, like Miriam Makeba. America knew nothing about the struggles of the people in Africa. Miriam Makeba came. She got the platform. Ed Sullivan was convinced that in his world, to let Miriam Makeba come on the program and to sing in Xhosa. And for him, it was an adventure. And he had been told by the programmers that they're not going to understand. And he said, oh, they'll understand. Harry likes it. It's good enough for me. And we got on the air, and there was Miriam Makeba singing these songs. And her popularity became quite intense.
Which was very important for the anti-apartheid struggle. Absolutely. Spreading into the United States.
Absolutely. Not only the anti-apartheid struggle, which spread in the United States, but for a greater understanding of the liberation of the whole continent. Because there was people like Sekou Toure and Nyerere and Tom Mboya, and all of the entire continent was awakened with the idea of liberation, and having African artists, eventually Huey Masekela and others, the whole idea of world music was seeded in the fact that the Banana Boat songs from the Caribbean, it opened up more music from Cuba and the whole power in Afro-Cuban jazz and what those great Cuban artists did who pollinated American jazz with such great harmonies and song. All that stuff was a melting pot for a greater truth.
Harry Belafonte speaking in 2011 on Democracy Now. He died Tuesday of congestive heart failure at the age of 96 here in New York. To see the rest of that interview and all of our interviews with Harry, go to democracynow.org. We'll hear more from Harry Belafonte in his own words when we come back. Brother by Harry Belafonte from the Grammy-winning album he made with the South African singer Miriam Makeba. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our coverage of the life and legacy of Harry Belafonte. He died Tuesday at the age of 96 here in New York of congestive heart failure. In 2003, on February 15th, he spoke before hundreds of thousands of people in New York City. It was a freezing cold day. It was a massive rally calling on the United States and President Bush not to invade Iraq.
Today is a historic and a proud day in the name of America. The world has sat by with tremendous anxiety and with great fear that we did not exist. They have been told and they have felt that what our country, with its press and the leaders in the administration, have said, we today invalidate all that. We stand for peace. We stand for the truth of what is at the heart of the American people. This is not the first time that we as a people have been misled by the leadership. We were misled by those who created the falseness of the Bay of Tonkin, which falsely led us into a war with Vietnam, a war that we could not and did not win. We lied to the American people about Grenada and what was going on in that tiny island. We've lied to the American people about Nicaragua, El Salvador, Cuba, and many places in the world. And we stand here today to let those people and others know that America is a vast and diverse country, and we are part of the greater truth of what makes our nation. Dr. King once said that if mankind does not put an end to war, war will put an end to mankind.
On that day, February 15, 2003, Harry Belafonte also spoke to Democracy Now! During our live broadcast right behind the stage of the global anti-war protests. Harry detailed his criticism of George W. Bush's Secretary of State Colin Powell for his role for pushing for the invasion of Iraq.
My comments about General Colin Powell is really not a personal confrontation. Black Americans and many peoples of color have always taken great pride in what those of us who have come from a history of oppression have achieved. And when an individual breaks through and becomes and comes into the place where decisions are made that can make a difference, we then have high expectations. Once that is rejected by those who have acquired this position, we may sit in quiet disappointment. But when the person who achieves that distinction then puts him or herself in the service of our oppression and those who create new ways in which to oppress us, that is morally unacceptable. And that is my argument with General Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. I expect, as do others, that their history should have prepared them for a much better articulation about how to treat people globally. Most of the people in the world who suffer from tyranny, most of the people in the world who suffer from the tyranny of oppression, the tyranny of hunger, the tyranny of ignorance, the tyranny of HIV/AIDS, there sits terror. And when you look very carefully at what it is that has caused this constant oppression, you will see that somewhere in there, America plays the game. And this gathering here today helps us understand that there is another America that is strong, that is resolute, and are made up of millions and millions of people. As a matter of fact, we do make the majority voice in this nation, and that we have let the world know that we are in solidarity with those who seek to have other ways than war to settle our grievances.
In 2006, Harry Belafonte traveled to Venezuela, where he met with President Hugo Chavez. Belafonte's trip made international headlines when he described President George W. Bush as the world's greatest terrorist.
I want the greatest tyrant in the world, the greatest terrorist in the world, George W. Bush says. We're here to tell you, not hundreds, not thousands, but millions of the American people, millions support your revolution, support your ideas, and we are expressing our solidarity with you.
President Chavez was standing right next to Harry Belafonte. Shortly after Harry returned from Venezuela, he came into our Firehouse studio to talk about why he called President George W. Bush a terrorist.
When Katrina took place, there was a great sense of tragic loss for many Americans who saw that terrible tragedy. What we had not anticipated was that our government would have been so negligent and so unresponsive to the plight of hundreds of thousands of people in the region. And in a dilemma that we all face as to what we could do as private citizens to help the folks that were caught in that tragedy, we began to listen to voices that were outside the boundaries of government, the United States government. We listened to voices that came from as far away as Denmark, who offered to send goods and services in emergency. And we also heard the voices of people from Venezuela through their leader, Hugo Chavez, who said that in this moment of your great tragedy, we, the Venezuelan people, will extend all the resources we can summon up to help the plight of those people caught in the Gulf region. The United States very abruptly and very arrogantly rejected that offer. While in its stead, we did nothing to bring immediate relief. And as a matter of fact, I must tell you, we're still quite delinquent in what the peoples of that region need, because we've still failed to fully mobilize and meet the needs of the people, particularly in New Orleans, but other places within that region. I and the many other private citizens decided that we would listen very carefully to what people outside of the government were saying, because there was no immediate sense of relief in response to what we were experiencing, the people in Katrina. And so, like others, I went with a delegation of 15 people at the invitation of the Venezuelan government to come and to meet with President Chavez and members of his cabinet to talk about what we could do to help American people caught in this tragedy. It is quite curious that we can find billions and billions of dollars to sustain an illegal and immoral war in the Middle East, invading a country that did not provoke us, and moving into this conflict unconstitutionally, even though it had the approval of the Congress. Even the Congress violated the statutes of the Constitution. We were not invaded. There was no threat of an enemy. We unilaterally walked into a country that had no threat to this country, and we invaded it. That's against the Constitution.
You call President Bush a terrorist?
I call President Bush a terrorist. I call those around him terrorists as well. Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld, Gonzalez in the Justice Department, and certainly Cheney. I think all of these men and women sit in the midst of an enormous conspiracy that has been unraveling America for the last 8 years, 6 years. It is tragic that the dubious way in which this president acquired power should have begun to unravel the Constitution and the peoples of this country. Yes, I say that there are people in this country who live in terror. Poverty is terror. Having your social security threatened is terror. Having your livelihood as an elderly person slowly disappearing with no replenishment is terror. Students who are dropping out of school because there are no resources to keep us in school is terror. You find people in the streets watching drugs permeate our communities and destroy our young. It's a life of terror. And men who sit in charge of that distribution mechanism, which can help the American people overcome these problems, and refuse to do so while giving the rich more money than they've ever dreamt of having, while turning around our institutions and redirecting resources from those who are truly in need to those who are already generously endowed, if not hedonistically so. It's a great tragedy.
That was Harry Belafonte on Democracy Now! On January 30th, 2006. After that interview, we learned Coretta Scott King had died. A dear friend of Coretta Scott King, Harry Belafonte was invited to speak at her funeral. But the invitation to speak was rescinded after George W. Bush announced he was attending Coretta Scott King's funeral. Harry Belafonte last appeared on Democracy Now! In 2016 at a special event at the historic Riverside Church in New York to celebrate Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary. He co-headlined the event with Noam Chomsky. It was the first time they'd done a public event together. Harry Belafonte spoke about Donald Trump, who'd just been elected president.
I believe that Trump and bringing a new energy to the realization of the vastness of the reach of the Ku Klux Klan is not something that has been out of our basic purview of thought. The Ku Klux Klan, for some of us, is a constant, has a constant existence. It isn't until it touches certain aspects of white America that white America all of a sudden wakes up to the fact that there's something called the Klan and that it does its mischief. What causes me to have great thought is something that's most unique to my experience. And as I said earlier tonight, at the doorstep of being 90 years of age, I had thought I'd seen it all and done it all, only to find out that at 89 I knew nothing. But the most peculiar thing to me has been the absence of a black presence in the middle of this resistance, not just the skirmishes that we've seen in Ferguson and Black Lives Matter. And I think those protests and those voices being raised are extremely important. But we blew this thing a long time ago. When they started the purge against communism in this country and against the voice of those who saw hope in a design for socialist theory and for the sharing of wealth and for the equality of humankind, when we abandoned our vision and vigils on that topic, I think we sold out ourselves. A group of young black students in Harlem just a few days ago asked me what at this point in my life was I looking for. And I said, what I've always been looking for, where resides the rebel heart? Without the rebellious heart, with about people who understand that there's no sacrifice we can make that's too great to retrieve that which we've lost, we will forever be distracted with possessions and trinkets and title. And I think one of the big things that happened was that when black people began to be anointed by the trinkets of this capitalist society and began to become big-time players and began to become heads of corporations, they became players in the game of our own demise. I think people have to be more adventurous. The heart has to find greater space for rebellion. For such thought, because I was just recently reminded of Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney. They sit particularly close to my own feelings and thoughts because I was one of the voices that was raised in recruiting those young students to participate in our rebellion.
David Goodman, Andrew's brother, is here today.
I'm sure of it. He's always at the right places. But I think that there are those kinds of extremes that will be experienced in the struggle. But the real nobility of our existence is, are we prepared to pay that price? And I think once the opposition understands that we are quite prepared to die for what we believe in, that death for a cause does not just sit with ISIS, but sit with people, workers, people who are generally prepared to push against the theft of our nation and the distortion of our Constitution, and that for many of us, no price is too great for that charge. I've been through much in this country. I came back from the Second World War, and while the world rejoiced in the fact that Hitler had been met and defeated, there were some of us who were touched by the fact that instead of sitting at the table of feast at that great victory, we were worried about our lives because the response from many in America was the murder of many black servicemen that came back. And we were considered to be dangerous because we had learned the capacity to handle weaponry. We had faced death in the battlefield. And when we came back, we had an expectation as the victors. We came back knowing that, yes, we might have fought to end Hitler, but we also fought for our right to vote in America. And that in the pursuit of such rights came the civil rights movement. Well, that can happen again. We just have to get out our old coats, dust them off, stop screwing around and just chasing the good times and get down to business. There's some ass kicking out here to be done, and we should do it.
Belafonte speaking in 2016 at the historic Riverside Church in New York to celebrate Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary. He co-headlined the event with Noam Chomsky. Harry died on Tuesday at the age of 96 of congestive heart failure at his home here in New York City. You can visit democracynow.org to see the full event, as well as all of our interviews with Harry Belafonte. Harry giving his speech in 2003 against the war in Iraq, Harry in Venezuela, Harry at the Sundance Film Festival when the documentary about him premiered, talking fully about his life, and so much more. That does it for our show. On Saturday, Juan Gonzalez will deliver the opening plenary address at a day-long policy forum at American University titled In Search of a New U.S. Policy for a New Latin America, Burying 200 Years of the Monroe Doctrine. Visit democracynow.org for more information. Oh, and special thanks to our archivist Brendan Allen and Charina Nadora for today's show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Felsmeyer, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Wernoff, Trina Nadora, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Chanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
Hide the deadly black torrents.
Are you inspired? Do you want to be? Tune in to The Arts Edge with Annie Roach, Saturdays from 6 to 7 p.m. and hear stories of artists and educators, writers, painters, actors, people from all walks of life. Hear how people are making their lives happen. You can find us at CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby Mountain. We're at TELUS HD Channel 7014. or you can find us on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. Tune in to The Arts Edge and be inspired.
Thank you for